only once you're on ship is it revealed what the target is and what you're going to be doing. You know you're going to be doing the invasion, but you don't know where it is or what time or quite what the circumstances or the precise beach you're going to be landing. You know, that all gets revealed on passage. In the early hours of the 6th of June, you know it's going to come. I mean, you won't be getting any sleep that night at all. You'll be fully charged. There's a swell of about a level 5. You know, as you're going in, you'd have been feeling sick, you'd have been feeling nervous, and then add that the weather. I mean, it would have been absolutely terrifying. You'd have got going just because that's what you're trying to do and because you don't have any choice in the matter. And, you know, conquering your fear and just going for it is just part and parcel of being in a war and being an infantryman. I mean, it's just something that you just have to face. But, you know, when the ramp goes down, that is, you know, pretty much the ultimate leap of faith.
Set the scene for a general public audience that knows a little bit about D-Day, but not much, and describe the situation in the war and the situation in France and Britain at that time. What's important to know preceding the war at a high level?
Well, I mean, the war has been going on in Europe since the 1st of September 1939, when Germany invades Poland. Britain and France both joined the war 2 days later on the 3rd of September. The United States, of course, doesn't actually actively get involved in the war until 7th of December 1941, the day of infamy when Japanese naval forces attack the American Pacific Fleet in Pearl Harbor. But America has been involved in that in the war beforehand, not least by absolutely massive rearming. And in actual fact, President Roosevelt had realized even in the summer of 1939 that the Atlantic was no longer quite the barrier that it had been, and that America needed to kind of get out of its isolationist view and urgently rearm. So it starts making some subtle changes and little kind of underhand alterations to laws and things, and increasing his own executive power as president in 1939, so that when he really needs to press the go button in the summer of 1940 following the defeat of France, you know, he's able to do that. And so begins this massive rearmament process creating what becomes known as the Arsenal of Democracy. But, you know, there's no getting away from the fact that the strategic earthquake has been the defeat of France in June 1940 and the defeat of Britain's army and its retreat back across the Channel. Britain's army is tiny compared to pretty much everyone else, as is the United States, for that matter, in 1939, 1940. But much of its equipment's been left behind. And, you know, in the alliance with France, France was going to do the army bit, Britain was going to do most of the naval bit and burgeoning air power. And so it's got to completely restart all over again. I mean, it's ground zero both for the United States in May, June 1940, and it is for Britain as well. And at the same time, of course, there is the lurking threat to the Japanese. So it takes time to kind of, you know, rebuild from the British point of view an army, from America's point of view, once it gets in the war at the end of 1941, to kind of, you know, get over to Britain, start building up forces. You know, it was a very, very small army, and you can't just sort of click your fingers and turn yourself into kind of world beaters. So, you know, this is a process. I mean, I think the point is that the Western Allies get their kind of priorities about right. You know, they focus predominantly on the Battle of the Atlantic, which is the number one most important theater in the Second World War, bar none. If you go for the kind of Germany first policy, which obviously being a Brit, I do, you know, I don't think Japan was a particularly a threat to global, I don't think Japan was quite the same threat that Nazi Germany was to kind of the world order. It was a massive threat. I don't want to undermine it, but it wasn't quite the same league as Nazi Germany and the kind of European axis. So through the Atlantic, everything flows. You know, the Western Allies, whatever they do, whether they're assaulting in North Africa, whether they're assaulting in Sicily later on in July 1943, whether they're going into Italy, whether they're doing a cross-channel invasion, everything has to come by sea, has to come by the Atlantic. I mean, a few things can be flown in, but for the most part, it's an Atlantic-based thing. And that also applies to stuff coming from India, from Australia. It's still got to go around the kind of southern part of Africa and then up into the Atlantic and then to Britain and so on, or into the Mediterranean. So the Atlantic is actually key, and they get to the point where they're not going to lose that by as early as sort of spring of 1941. Similarly, Germany then goes into the Soviet Union in June 1941 because it's had these sort of sweeping successes in 1939, 1940, and into the first part of 1941, but already the cupboard is bare. I mean, they've been like kids in a sweet shop, just sort of cleaned everything out, whether it be France, whether it be Norway, whether it be Denmark, whether it be the Balkans, whatever. And they just don't have enough of anything. They don't have enough natural resources themselves. They don't have access to the world's oceans. A large part of their very best troops have been in action since the start. And they need more Lebensraum. They need more living space. They need all the benefits of a huge land empire that the Soviet Union would give them, not least natural resources, including kind of, you know, pretty much every ore you can think of, as well, of course, as oil. So they go in June 1941, well before they're ready to do so, and where they're also being, just before that, being distracted by kind of forays into the Mediterranean, such as, you know, Greece and Balkans and invasion of Crete and so on, all of which have been victorious for them, but very costly as well. And the truth of the matter is in the middle of June 1941, the Soviet Nazi Germany's got one enemy, which is Britain, albeit Britain plus dominions and empire. So when I mean dominions, I mean Canada, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and of course India. Whereas fast forward 6 months to middle of December 1941, it's suddenly got three enemies. It's got the Soviet Union, USA, and Great Britain plus the dominions and empire. It is simply not going to win from that point. You know, so you know, the traditional reason why people give up in wars is because, or throw in the towel, is because they've run out of money and they're not going to win. Well, you know, those conditions are there in place by December 1941, but it's a slow death because Hitler has this incredible hold over the German people and over the people of the Third Reich, and he's a kind of all or nothing kind of Armageddon or Thousand Year Reich kind of guy, and there's no kind of middle ground. So the war goes on and on and on, and it's not really till the middle of 1943, well, really with the end of the campaign in North Africa, which comes to a conclusion on 13th of May 1943, that the Western Allies really sort of get their act together and kind of work out how they're going to go around doing and beat Nazi Germany. And this is by a marriage of air, land, and sea, a huge amount of emphasis on air power, because, you know, you're trying to let machinery and technology and global reach and modernity do a lot of the hard yards. So you're not killing kind of, you know, a huge generation of young men. That's the kind of principle behind it. And broadly speaking, it's pretty successful compared to, you know, when you compare America and the casualties of the United States or the casualties of Britain compared to the other major combatant nations, it's pretty impressive. You know, they're nothing like as much as the kind of, you know, 9 million suffered by Germany, or the kind of 30 million suffered by the Soviet Union, and 10 million suffered by Japan, et cetera, et cetera. So broadly speaking, it works, but it takes time. And the combined chiefs of staff in May 1943 decide, right, May 1944 is when we're going to be doing the cross-channel invasion. We've got to do this. The only way we're going to defeat Nazi Germany is to actually get a foothold back onto the continental Europe, get in there and get in there fast. But the problem, this comes with a huge amount of challenges, not least because the moment you land on the beaches of, let's say, Normandy, which is where they go for, the cat is out of the bag. And then it's a race between who can build up men and material quickest. Is it going to be the Allies, who've got their, you know, huge amounts of bases and millions of men and stockpiles of ammunition and everything you could possibly want in Britain, but which has to then be sailed for the most part across the sea, a journey of sort of anything between kind of 80 and 120 miles in a slow vessel? Or is it going to be the Germans, who are already on the continent? And obviously on paper, it looks good for the Germans. So the challenge for the Allies is to slow up the ability of the Germans to kind of reinforce Normandy. And you only do that by attacking their own lines of transport, their own lines of communication. And you only do that by blowing up bridges and attacking marshalling yards. The Germans are very, very dependent on the Reichsbahn, which is a German railway system. They're very over-dependent on that. And roads and railway locomotives and so on. But you can only do that by very accurate bombing. And you can only do that by very low-level bombing. And you can only do that if you haven't got lots of Focke Wulfs and Messerschmitt German fighters hovering above you. So you've got to clear a huge swathe of the enemy out of the airspace of the whole large part of Northwest Europe before you can even consider getting into a landing craft or a ship and going across the English Channel. And that is problematic in the autumn of 1943 and prompts this massive crisis in the Allied command, particularly, I would say, in the United States 8th Air Force, you know, which is the subject of the recent series of Masters of the Air for example. Because the problem is that to destroy the German aircraft industry, you have to go deep into the Reich. And to go deep into the Reich, you have to go beyond fighter escort, the range of a fighter plane that can escort the heavy bombers. And the moment they do that, they get absolutely slaughtered. So the race is on to try and find a long-range fighter. But in the meantime, great emphasis is put on the airfield complex at Foggia in Italy. So that becomes another priority, which then comes to the detriment of the ground forces in Italy, which causes a whole load of complications as well. But to cut a long story short, by the middle of April 1945, those conditions have been met. They have cleared airspace. And by the end of May 1944, the closest German fighter plane to the invasion front is 500 miles away. So it's kind of, you know, slam dunk, job done, hooray. They've also managed to kind of knock out most of the German radar chain along that huge sway of the coast. So the conditions are really there. And the way the Allies fight a war is to is to use technology and this global reach and huge ability to kind of manufacture vast amounts of material, very much to their advantage, and to leave as little to chance as you possibly can, because doing a cross-channel invasion of this scale is just absolutely enormous. It's fraught with risk, and that means you've got to win the intelligence war, you've also got to win the logistical war, you've got to win the build-up war, you've got to kind of have your men trained, you've got to have enough landing craft. There's never enough landing craft. So USA alone, between May 1942 and April 1943, managed to produce 8,719 landing craft of various kinds, which sounds like a huge amount, and it is. But landing craft are a new beast, so they're starting pretty much afresh. I mean, the first Higgins boat, the classic kind of Saving Private Ryan boat, for to transport infantry to a beach, you know, only trials in May 1941. You know, landing ships, these big 120 meter long, absolutely the most important landing craft of all, you know, there's just not that many of them. And you're also competing with the Pacific theater, which is drawing off a huge amount of resources, and which has to be completely amphibious because of all those, you know, those islands and atolls and stuff in the middle of the Pacific. You know, they can only be attacked by sea, and you know that requires a huge amount of land craft. So there's a huge amount of competition for it. So the demands are many. There's also huge minefields off the Normandy coastline, which will have to be cleared, and it's the biggest single mine sweeping operation immediately ahead of the invasion force. But you know, the figures are absolutely mind boggling. I mean, you're talking about 6,939 vessels in the Armada. You're talking about 4,127 landing craft. You're talking about 1,213 warships, and you're talking about 12,500 aircraft involved. You know, and that's before you talk about your 155,000 personnel, which are going to be either dropped or landed on D-Day itself. So you know, it's a huge, huge, huge undertaking, and that's just day one. Meanwhile, on the Eastern Front, you know, the Russians have been clawing back from, ever since so basically the opening salvo, Operation Barbarossa, launched in June 1941. It doesn't achieve what it needs to do. The Germans get stuck there. They then get pushed back a little bit in the winter of 1941. They get sort of undone by the kind of snow and freezing temperatures and all the rest of it. But then come the summer of 1942, they have another crack, and the aim is to get down to the Caucasus and get to the oil fields there. But they get distracted in a very, very big way by taking Stalingrad, which they fail to do, and they get encircled, and the 6th Army stuck in the middle of Stalingrad gets completely annihilated. And that's a terrible moment, and that surrender comes in beginning of February 1943. And then in the summer they do another attempt to kind of try and sort of push the Soviet Union back, the Red Army back at Kursk, get pushed back in turn, and from that moment on there's no more kind of advancing east. It's all going backwards. And just as the Western Allies are preparing for D-Day, Operation Overlord, in the beginning of June 1944, the Red Army is preparing for Operation Bagration, which is going to be launched in the third week of June, on 22nd of June 1944 as well. So that's going to be a huge, huge, huge undertaking. So, you know, the whole idea is to kind of sort of crush the Third Reich in a sort of giant pincer, sort of three-pronged pincer from the kind of south in Italy, from main effort from the Allied point of view in France, and then across the Channel, but then also in southern France as well, which is going to be Operation Dragoon, which will eventually be launched on the 15th of August. And then, of course, on the Eastern Front with the Red Army coming from the east. So that's the situation.
Brilliant. Thank you for sharing all that. And I'd love to go into, you gave some detail about just the vastness and the scale and the size of the Armada crossing the English Channel into France that day. I'd love as best we can to give people some detail to help their imagination with what that day was really like for someone involved in that operation. Obviously, the war, as you just described, seemed to be going well for the Allies at that point. But for someone who is in one of those Higgins boats, who is in one of those naval vessels that's crossing the English Channel, you talk a lot in your book about the sense of camaraderie and how important that was with the Allies. Talk to the audience about what it was like to be there on that day, the visuals of witnessing such a vast amount of force going into one very specific area to try to win the war. Any detail you'd like to share with that? I know people would love to hear.
Well, yes. I mean, if you're let's just say, for example, you're an infantryman, you'd have been loaded up, several days beforehand. I mean, originally the invasion was going to take place on the 5th of June, then the weather came in and the decision was made that actually it would be better to postpone it by 24 hours, but most of the people were already on board. And if you're an infantryman, you'd probably be on a transport ship with landing craft, the Higgins boats, which are much smaller, on kind of sort of derricks on the side. So you'd go over in that, but conditions would be incredibly cramped. I mean, you're literally cramming as many people as you can into these ships. So this is not like going across on a sort of Cunard kind of, 1930s kind of style. I mean, it's pretty, pretty brutal. American ships are a bit better than British in terms of the food. They still have Coca-Colas and ice cream and stuff like that. So they're kind of feeding them up as much as they possibly can. And then in the kind of, there's the uncertainty of it. Once you're on ship, is it revealed what the target is and what you're going to be doing. You know you're going to be doing the invasion, but you don't know where it is or what time or quite what the circumstances or the precise beach you're going to be landing. That all gets revealed, on passage. And then in the early hours of the 6th of June, you know it's going to come. I mean, you won't be getting any sleep that night at all. You'll be too absolutely fully charged to be doing that. And then probably around kind of 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, you're getting into the landing craft, and either they've already been lowered and you've got to go down on rope nets, which is difficult because the swell is high, so you've got to judge it, and lots of people kind of breaking ankles and hurting themselves and dislocating shoulders and stuff as they're going in, or you just get lowered in the boat. Then you're circling around because you've then got to form up. So you've got to form up. The idea is that you would have engineers going in first and sort of clearing beach obstacles on the beach because the Germans know that the Allies are going to land somewhere. So all the beaches have got sort of mines and booby trapped and wire and so on. So, engineers are going just a little bit ahead to try and sort of clear some of those obstacles. And then you're moving in and the first wave are going in and you're being bucked around all over the place because you think about it, there's a swell of about, I don't know, it's about a level five, something like that. So it's not kind of stormy, but it's rough. And these are flat bottom boats. And the problem is, of course, is that the wind is, you're going, from the north to the south, and the wind is coming literally 90 degrees to the direction you're trying to go. You're in a flat bottom boat with a flat side. The flat side acts like a sail and everyone starts getting pushed slightly to one side. And the problem is you've got these, particularly if you're taking, let's say, for example, Omaha Beach, which is where two divisions of American infantry land, the 29th Infantry, which is a greenhorn, new to combat, and the 1st Infantry Division, which is incredibly experienced, has been landed in Iran in November 1942 and has been on Sicily and so on. You know where the strong points are. The strong points are where there are exits off the beach because that's the most obvious place. And so that's where the defenses are strongest. And you want to kind of land in between those, ideally, where the defenses are the weakest. But but the wind is pushing the people across. And so what happens, particularly in the case of the 29th Infantry, is that they kind of land absolutely where they, most of them in the first wave, don't want to be. I mean, there's one platoon, assault platoon from Company A, of the assault infantry, that just gets completely destroyed because a mortar round lands in the middle of the landing craft. It's like everyone gone, just like that. You know, so, you know, casualties incredibly high in the first wave. And you would have just, you know, as you're going in, you'd have been feeling sick. You'd have been feeling nervous. You know, whatever nerves would be making you feel pretty heavy stomached anyway. And then add that the weather. I mean, it would have been absolutely terrifying. And you just would not know what to expect, you know, but you could sort of just about peek out if you're tall. You look out over the top and you just see these sort of gray bluffs and you'd see the kind of drizzle coming in across you, the wind whipping around you, waves would come over, you'd all be absolutely soaked, it'd be completely discombobulating, there'd be lots of smoke, there'd be a huge amount of noise from, you know, offshore naval guns, the sound would just be absolutely immense. But you know, you'd have got going just because that's what you're trying to do, and because you don't have any choice in the matter, and you know, conquering your fear and just going for it is just part and parcel of being in a war and being an infantryman. I mean, it's just something that you just have to face. But, you know, when the ramp goes down, that is, you know, pretty much the ultimate leap of faith.
Yeah. I would love to get into some of the key concepts you go over in your book in a second, but I'd be remiss if I didn't go over the historical significance of that moment. And I don't know where you come down as a historian on whether this is the most important battle in history or where you think it ranks in historical scale, but I'd love to give some time to what these soldiers may have understood about the importance of what they were embarking upon. Obviously, they were probably, most of them, terrified and as nervous as they could possibly be, but was there a sense in your judgment that they were doing something that was truly monumental, truly historic?
Yeah, I think everyone knew that this was a big moment in history, and it truly was. I mean, you know, the British Army came back across the Channel in, you know, June 1940, and with the exception of a few kind of commando raids and the ill-fated Dieppe raid, that had been it. So this is first time back, you know, and France has been conquered and run by the oppressive Nazi regime since June 1940. And, you know, that's 4 years later. I mean, it's like a big, big moment. Everyone knew this was an absolutely key turning point. And the truth of the matter is if the Allies won in Normandy, that's it. I mean, you know, then the Germans would be defeated. There would be no more. There might be kind of some setbacks along the way or whatever, but the pattern would be set. You know, it's a point of no return from German perspective. You know, it would just be the sliding decline. So everyone knew it was a big moment. I think it is a big moment. I think it is a big moment in global history. I'm not saying it's necessarily the biggest moment, but I think it is a massive moment because it's the kind of sort of pinnacle of the coalition. You know, this can only be achieved by everyone pulling together. And yeah, it's a multinational thing. You know, Britain is also producing, you know, supplying America with 32% of all its supplies in the ETO. So, you know, even Lend-Lease cuts both ways. You know, it's not just America that's providing it all, for example. And what you see is a totally united command. You know, there are differences of opinion, there are personality clashes, and so on. But what is amazing about the coalition, and this is the irony, because they're not actually allies in the strictest terms of the word, they're coalition partners. They get on incredibly well. That, you know, they're collegiate, they work together, they're working towards a common goal, and that coordination of manpower and effort, all, you know, which is a lot of it is American industrial muscle, but it's coming from Britain and the islands of the United Kingdom. That's really, really impressive. And, you know, don't forget the Canadians, who punched massively above their weight in the Second World War. They were going to get left out of the narrative, but they're supplying an army onto a beach and one of the five invasion beaches, and they massively punch above their weight in the Navy and in the RAF as well. So you know, it is properly a coalition effort. There are also Polish units and French units and Norwegian units and Dutch and Belgian, you know, there's all sorts. So, you know, there's a huge number of different nationalities involved. And I think it's important to kind of that everyone understands it's not just sort of, you know, Americans jumping on at Omaha Beach. You know, D-Day is a much bigger thing. And actually, in terms of casualties, the greatest casualties as a proportion of those landed are suffered by the Canadians at Juneau Beach, not the Americans at Omaha. There are more casualties at Omaha than there are on Juneau, but that's because there's two divisions, not one. So, you know, it's an incredible moment. My own view is that I don't think the Germans have much chance of stopping it. I think the Allies are just too well prepared. And I think this is one of the things that people sort of forget about is it's very easy to focus on the guy jumping out of the landing craft. And, you know, well, that's understandable because that's the greatest human drama. And then the cold face and all the rest of it. But, you know, this is a year in the planning and this is, again, it's air, land, and sea. It's such a coordinated effort. It's not only is it multinational, it's also multi-service, it's tri-service. You know, that requires a hell of a lot of coordination. You know, everyone who's in the, you know, the right person's got to be in the right landing craft and land at the right part of the beach at the right time, you know, through the right channels that have been cleared through the minefields off the coast at between 7 and 10 miles, et cetera, et cetera. And it's got to be coordinated with air power and bombing and fighter planes and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's an awful lot to go wrong and an awful lot goes right, even despite the weather. And that's because of the contingencies that's been factored into it. And that's because of the exceptional nature of the planning of this entire operation. I mean, there's no GPS then. There's no WhatsApp group. You know, there's no Snapchat to kind of check that everyone's in the right place. This is all done analog. And it's just phenomenal. And, you know, just imagine what 12,500 aircraft looks like. I mean, that's just mind-boggling.
Yeah. There's a scene, I think, in Band of Brothers where there's a quick snapshot. Obviously, it's fictitious, but of what that looked like, I'm sure, with a lot of CGI. And it is breathtaking to witness. I need to go back and rewatch that scene specifically. I want to get into one of the key concepts in your book and give you some time to speak about it. And I want to read something very briefly and then give this to you. This is a line from your book about some of the specifics of in the war. You call it something called, quote, big war for the Allies. And this is the line in the info from the book that only 14% of the Allies are in the infantry and 7% are in tanks. 45% are service troops, whereas 70% of troops are frontline troops for Germany. You have a concept in your book, which I love and have thought a lot about since coming across it, which is steel, not flesh. And yeah. I want to give you some time to flesh that out and to give you some space to detail what that means and the importance of that general philosophy in the ultimate victory for the Allies in Normandy in the Second World War.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, but both Britain is absolutely determined that it's not going to lose another generation of infantry, you know, to the infantry as they had in the First World War, you know, where kind of sort of over 900,000 people were killed and, you know, a whole generation was swept aside. There was a similar sense of from the American Expeditionary Force as well, that although they came in 1917, you know, they also suffered a huge number of losses and it was sort of seen out of all proportion to, you know, it left a very, very kind of ugly scar. And I think both Britain and America came to the same conclusions that in any future war, they wanted to use modernity and technology and to try and do the hard yard. So, you know, that's one of the main principles behind the Strategic Air Campaign, which is the Strategic Air Campaign. You know, what we're talking about is the sort of heavy bombers going over and flattening German cities. And you can argue the morality of that, but that is to try and ensure that the war is as difficult to protract for the Germans as possible. And obviously, you know, a 7-man crew of a Lancaster or a 10-man crew of a B-17 or a B-24 Liberator, you know, that's a hell of a lot less than a division of 15,000 men. And, you know, even if you're kind of sending over, you know, 350 or even 1,000 heavy bombers, like, yeah, that's still comparatively small numbers of men in the big scheme of things, you know, compared to a major assault. on land. So that's one of the reasons behind it. And when I say still not flesh, what I should more accurately call it is still not our flesh. They're very happy to kind of, you know, obliterate Germans and Japanese or whatever. But try, the aim is to try and keep the numbers of casualties down to an absolute bare minimum. And broadly speaking, that works very well. The problem with it is that you've still got to take land. And you can only take land by men getting out of their foxholes, getting from their places of cover and advancing over open ground and taking it. And that's incredibly difficult and incredibly dangerous. So we focus on the infantry so much in the telling of the war or in the armor because that's the most dramatic. And they're the ones who are in the firing line more than anybody else. Now, obviously, you know, artillery are, and so are engineers as well. But you know, if you're going to be square about it, it is still the infantry and armor that are facing the most danger. And the casualty rates are just horrific. I mean, they're absolutely horrific. So, you know, the Germans, for example, have something like 300 divisions in the Second World War. You know, Britain, including its dominions, never has more than kind of 56 or something. You know, so it's much, much smaller. But if you were unfortunate enough to be in one of those infantry units, then your chances of getting through unscathed are worse than they were in the Second World War. And, you know, and a case in point is the Normandy campaign, because if you take the number, total number of casualties and divide it by the days of the battle, you get an average daily casualty rate. Well, the casualty rate of the Normandy campaign, the 77-day Normandy campaign, is 6,875 or something like that, which is actually worse than Verdun, the Passchendaele, and the Somme, which are kind of, you know, considered to be bywords for the kind of, you know, slaughter of the First World War. So, you know, it's really bad news. You think about the 4th Infantry Division, which loses something like 43 men killed on D-Day, but then has like 100% turnaround of its frontline troops within 2 weeks of kind of fighting up the Cotentin Peninsula. You know, you think about armored units, well, you know, they might only amount for 7% of the personnel. And of that 7%, only 48% are actually in tanks, because 52% are echelons, you know, support units, bringing up the ammunition, food supplies, light aid detachments, you know, maintenance, all that kind of stuff. So of that 7%, it's actually only, you know, basically 3.5%, which are actually in tanks. But again, you know, if you're in a tank, your chances of getting through unscathed are statistically zero. Between D-Day and the end of the war. I mean, you take one regiment, the Sherwood Rangers, who are a British armored regiment. They start off on D-Day with 36 officers, which is sort of standard for 688 men in an armored regiment in the British Army. Just by the end of the Normandy campaign, they've had 44 officer casualties. You know, and that's repeated across the board. So it's an unbelievably dangerous business being an infantryman or being in a tank in the Second World War.
Fascinating. Another key concept that you go over, and I'd love to try to paint this picture for the audience too, to get a better understanding of what the situation was like in early June of 1944, and that's the Atlantic Wall. And you go into some detail in your book about what that is, and I'd love to give you some space to detail that and whatever additional information you'd like to share with that.
Okay,
as well.
So. Of course. So when you're thinking of big walls, you might be thinking of the kind of, you know, the kind of half-finished border in New Mexico, or you might be thinking of the Great Wall of China, this sort of, you know, like sort of disappears over one hill to the next hill and it's still going along with its sort of castellated front. It's not that. It is not a solid wall. But this is a series of defenses that run from the Arctic Circle up in the northern part of Norway all the way down to the border, southern border of France and Spain and the Pyrenees. And obviously, certain areas are more heavily defended than others. So, probably the most heavily defended of all is a bit around the Pas de Calais, which is the narrowest part of the English Channel, and sort of going up into Holland and Belgium, and then just immediately south of the Pas de Calais, you know, down towards kind of Dieppe and Le Havre and that kind of neck of the woods. And then it sort of gets progressively kind of thinner again. You know, on the Normandy coast, and that's why the Allies are going for the Normandy coastline, because it's, although it's further away for them to travel, you know, it's not as close as it is going just straight across the kind of southeast, from southeast corner of England across the Channel to France. It's much less well defended. And actually, there's only 32 heavy guns along the entire Normandy coastline. Well, there's 15,000 in Germany alone. You know, so it's a different kettle of fish. And the whole wall is connected by beach defenses where there's beaches. So wire, you know, anti-invasion obstacles. So these are posts which sort of stick up out of the sand with a kind of mine on it, you know, a booby trap on the end. concrete casements and bunkers, some for housing guns, some for just like little weapons pits and mortar pits and stuff. And they're all interconnected and they've got sort of enfilading fire and so on. But as I say, of kind of sort of variable degrees of depth and strength, but there's something like 9,800 individual bits of concrete along the Atlantic Wall, of which 99% never see any action whatsoever. And actually, one of the most extraordinary parts of the Atlantic Wall, where 10% of the budget gets spent, is on what were the British Channel Islands, you know, Guernsey and Jersey and stuff, which are just off the off the Normandy coast. I mean, utterly pointless. The British abandoned them right from the word go, and you know, they're of no strategic value whatsoever. And you know, Hitler absolutely insists on. And when you go there now, I mean, you can see these huge underground hospitals and huge great towers and flak towers and, you know, enormous casements. And it makes the Normandy coastline look like kind of sort of child's play compared to what's on the Channel Lines. So you can see what the Atlantic Wall could be when you did it properly. But the other problem is, of course, is you're using forced labor to build most of this. And by this stage of the war, you know, and that's also variable quality. And as the war progresses, so they've got less fuel, they've got less oil, which means they've got less means of transport, which means you're more dependent on local resources, which might be a variable quality. So a lot of you can really see the really good, if you go to Normandy today, you can see the good stuff and the kind of cheapo, kind of not so good. And you know, the differences are absolutely enormous. And so it's a very much a sort of mixed bag. But really the defenses there are not very good, not least because the people that are manning them are very, very substandard, what we call static infantry divisions, because there's not enough fuel by the stage of war, there's not enough transport. So they're dependent on kind of horse and cart and just staying put. And most of them aren't German troops either. They're troops in German uniforms, which is not quite the same thing. So in other words, they're conscripted from Ukraine, from Baltic states, from Poland, from Czechoslovakia, these sort of places. People who absolutely have no interest in being there whatsoever and are going to be very happy to kind of hend a hock, you know, put their hands up the moment the Allies turned up. So, you know, you're not talking about quality, but be that as it may, you know, attacking fixed defences from the sea is incredibly challenging, you know, no matter what the quality of your troops are. The real quality troops in Northwest Europe, from the German point of view, are the 10 mobile divisions. There's 9 panzer divisions and 1 panzer grenadier division, and these are all kind of, you know, they've got this is an all arms unit division of, you know, between 15 and 22,000 men, you know, bristling with weaponry and tanks and self propelled guns, which are kind of, you know, artillery or anti tank guns on a tracked chassis. Loads of machine guns. They're all German troops. They're all gung ho. They're all kind of up for it. You know, they're better trained than the static divisions. And they've got a cadre of really experienced people who've kind of been there, done it, got the T-shirt. So, you know, those are the ones you need to worry about. But, you know, 10 divisions against the kind of, you know, full weight of the Allies is, you know, maybe not that much of a problem. So the challenge for the Allies, though, is to be able to get a firm enough foothold onto the Normandy Peninsula, the Normandy coastline, before these 10 divisions can get to Normandy and form themselves up into a coordinated counterattack. And when they do come, most of the divisions are, these German divisions are sort of spread to the four winds, and they've also got to contend with Allied air power. And of course, you know, it's June, so the days are long, which means the hours of darkness are less. So the hours where you can move from A to B if you're German without being seen by Allied fighter planes is comparatively short in a 24-hour period. And, you know, the truth is all of them get absolutely hammered en route to Normandy. So they're all taking a number of hits before they even get to the front. And when they do, you know, they're not arriving quick enough. So that has allowed already the Allies a chance to kind of, you know, build up probably a kind of overwhelming amount of men and material. And when the British you put in the first major offensive, which is Operation Epsom, which is launched on the 26th of June, 1944. So kind of, you know, 20 days later. And, when they do attack, they just suck in all these panzer divisions arriving. But of course, you know, a panzer division of let's say 18,000 men doesn't arrive at once. It arrives in different units and, you know, on different march routes. And it takes time. So what's happening? Because there's this big offensive, they're just ordered straight into the attack the moment they arrive, and they haven't had a chance to reconnoitre the ground or anything like that. It's not very well coordinated. They're losing kind of unit cohesion, and they get pushed back. And although the British in that first offensive, Operation Epsom, aren't able to do a kind of decisive breakthrough, they basically, after that attack has gone in, and the Germans have failed to kind of push them back, it's kind of game over, really. I mean, you know, it's hard to say at that stage, at the beginning of July 1944, how long it will take to clear up Normandy and when the big breakthrough will happen. But it is going to happen. It's only a matter of time. It's not a matter of if.
I want to read a couple quotes from your book and then follow up on them. And these are two. The first one is this, quote, "Unlike the Germans, Allied servicemen were not going to be shot for desertion. It was why maintaining morale was so important. There was nothing really to stop them throwing down their weapons and walking away." The second one is, quote, "The large majority of conscripted troops, and both armies were around 75% conscripts, did not want to fight in the war, would never have entered the military were it not for the global conflict now raging, and simply hoped to keep their heads down and get through it." I want to go into a little bit about something that I brought up a little while ago, which is the spirit of cooperation and the importance of morale specific to the Allies. And I did a show recently about the rise of Hitler, and I've read some recent information about the state of just outright mass murder on the Eastern Front of Germans to Soviets and vice versa, that there was really very little respect given to prisoners of war in many circumstances, from my understanding. But I'd love to go into some of the people who were fighting in this on the Allied side and what you think matters to a general audience to know about the importance of cooperation and morale. Obviously, a lot of people who come across this may have seen Saving Private Ryan or Band of Brothers. What's the truth about the importance of just the spirit of the men and the importance of morale and cooperation among these people fighting this coordinated effort?
Well, I think there's three things really. I think it's the dominance of air power. I think that gives the guys on the ground a kind of sense that they've got guys above them that can help them out if worst comes to worst. And you know, they can be called in, and I think seeing them, that just gives them a sense of kind of, you know, you've got a whole weight of force on your, you know, behind that's got your back, basically. So I think that's really important. Second thing is letters, getting letters and getting them fast and getting them from home. And with that is supplies and food, and making sure that you do get plenty of food and that, you know, you're not on the kind of K rations for too long at any one time. And you have enough cigarettes, you have enough coffee, you have enough, in the case of British, tea, and so on. So food and letters and kind of home comforts in a time where there are very few home comforts. The third thing is making sure that you don't push them too hard. So, you know, in Normandy, Allied troops are not, you can be in the line for several weeks, but you're not going to be attacking for probably more than about 24, 48 hours max. And then you're pulled out and another company goes in or another battalion goes in or whatever and takes over. So you're at the front, but you're not apt at the time when you're absolutely at the coalface is quite small. And then once a battle is kind of passed, it's very rare that an offensive lasts for more than kind of 4 to 6 days. You know, and that's so there's a bit of a kind of battering ram effect. You know, you go in really hard and everyone's exhausted and everyone kind of just pauses for a bit and kind of, you know, shakes down, gets some replacements up, thinks about it, goes, you know, and that point then the guys in the front line pulled out of the line and then they go back to rest camps. They're given a chance to swim in the sea. You know, the American Red Cross or the NAFI vans come up in the case of the British and, you know, beer's handed round and there's, you know, donuts and hot dogs and, you know, a mobile bath unit. So you're given fresh uniforms and, you know, these are small things, but they're things that you can hold on to and you can keep going for kind of 4 days. You can keep going for 24 hours. It's the kind of relentlessness when it's going on for weeks that's a problem. The Germans have none of that kind of luxury. You know, they're not treated anything like as well as that. And, you know, the replacements that are coming in are huge. So, you know, the 4th Infantry Division is sort of, you know, completely replaced within, you know, in terms of fighting men, you know, several times over in Normandy. Whereas in the same time that, you know, the British and American and Canadian units are constantly being topped up and additional divisions arriving, replacement troops for the German units are maybe like 10%. I mean, you know, it's just hopeless. So their fighting capacity is just going down and 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 down. And you know, more is being expected from fewer men. So the fatigue levels are just at a point where you just literally can't cope, and that's what's happening to the Germans, you know. And when the breakthrough finally happens, with Operation Cobra, which launched on 25th July 1944. That is the point where the Germans just cannot hold on any longer. That's the point of it, really.
I believe in your book you mentioned the name Dick Winters, if I remember correctly. And yep. I'd love to give a little time. Obviously, he's a specific man that most people who are nerds about this stuff came across in Band of Brothers. But I'd love to give a little bit of time to his story and the men like him that, you know, you think really matters for an audience that may never meet people that actively fought in World War II. They're really dying out now. And, you know, D-Day was 80 years ago.
Yeah.
What do we know about, you know, maybe Dick Winters specifically and men like him that up until Band of Brothers were, you know, faceless citizens in our respective countries who, probably no one knew what they had gone through. What's important to know about, you know, men like him to a modern audience, what they went through, what they contributed, what's important from a historical perspective about people like him?
Sure. Well, I mean, I can talk about specifically about Dick Winters. I mean, you know, he's a very smart guy. You know, he's a classic kind of citizen soldier. The thing about the airborne divisions is that they're all volunteers, so they want to be there. So they're just a little bit more capable of using their initiative. You know, they're not so much of the kind of just, I'm doing this because I've got to, I'm forced to, I don't want to be here, just get my head down. You know, Sarge, can you just show me where to go? I mean, you know, these are people who can think on their feet and want to think on their feet and actively want to be good soldiers, you know. So there's a unit cohesion there. There's a sort of pride. There's a kind of level of excellence, which is kind of higher than kind of your average infantry division, probably. He just happens to be very lucky in that you know, he survived, and, you know, kept a lot of papers and, you know, hooked up with Stephen Ambrose, which is why Easy Company of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment is so famous. But actually, you know, the 82nd Airborne did more work than the 101st in the Second World War. And, you know, there's plenty of people like that. I mean, I think the thing that's really, really strikes me is in recent years, obviously you made the point that a lot of these veterans are fading away pretty fast, but their footprints, their imprints are still there. And, not least in diaries and letters and stuff, and a well-written letter and a well-written diary is really kind of, it's just incredible because the characters of these people just really, really oozes off every single page. I can absolutely tell you, whether it's Dick Winters or whether it's whoever it is, these guys are entirely recognizable. Yeah. I mean, you and I reading them would absolutely recognize the type, whatever that type is. You know, that their anxieties, their concerns, their things that annoy them, the things that make them laugh, the kind of humor, the black humor, the kind of irritations, the anger. All of them are just entirely recognizable as people that you and I would know. And that makes them very real. And they're suddenly not kind of monochrome black and white figures. They are real people in 3D, you know, where you're putting flesh back onto the bones again by kind of reading their words. And those words were written on that particular day that they're written. You know, they don't know how the Normandy campaign is going to play out. They don't know whether they're going to survive. They don't know what's, you know, when VE Day is going to happen and so on. And so what I would say is that these guys, so people of a kind of modern audience today, these are people that you know. You know, they absolutely are everyday Joes who are just having to suck it up and get on with it and do it. Just like, you know, the Ukrainians are, or frankly, even the Russian soldiers are as well. You know, just having to do it because they don't really need choice in the matter. And, you know, we live in very, very troubled times at the moment. And, you know, the US is flexing its muscles and they're kind of Indo-Pacific at the moment. And, you know, trouble lies on the horizon with Taiwan and so on and so forth. So, you know, it may well be that you know, further conventional wars on a large scale are fought again, you know, in the not too distant future. And that our young men in Europe and in the United States will be facing exactly the same thing. So, you know, it's incredibly pertinent. What I would say is that, you know, since the troubles in the Middle East and in recent times and the war in Ukraine and so on, and the kind of destabilizing of global order, it does make you think about the Second World War in a slightly different way. It's not just something that's happened then, will never happen again, we'll never have to go through it. You just don't know. You just don't know. And I never thought I'd say that 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah. I know we're getting close to the end of our time together, and this has been absolutely terrific. I would love to close with maybe two different subjects. And one is, you know, you've spent, obviously, just in looking at your life's work, so much of your life on Normandy and on the Second World War. And I'd love to give you some time to answer why. Why does this phase of history, these men that you profile, this point and moment in history, why does it matter to global history and also to you?
Yeah, I see. When I was a young kid, I was really into it, you know, and, you know, we had kind of Action Man and Commando Comics, which we had over here in the UK, and, you know, making models and so on. And of course, you know, one watched war films and stuff on a Saturday afternoon when it was raining. But then I kind of sort of put it to one side, and it wasn't until I was in comparatively my 20s, I was actually playing cricket. I'm a cricket obsessive. I know, obviously, you know, cricket's not the American sport, it's baseball for the summer, but I'm a cricket nut. And suddenly a Spitfire flew over. And it was the most amazing thing. And I thought, wow, that's just incredible. And funny enough, the very next weekend was Flying Legends at Duxford, which is a kind of sort of Second World War air base, which is now a kind of a museum and still an active airfield. And, you know, they do these kind of sort of warbird shows and what have you. And it was incredible. And that was the moment. And I started thinking about a novel, which ended up being called The Burning Blue. A sort of backdrop of the Battle of Britain. I went off sort of start interviewing people that were still around. I really got into it in a very, very big way. I just, you know, I'm like a lot of blokes, you know, you get hold of something, you become a little bit obsessed. And, you know, I was talking to all these Battle of Britain veterans, and they were just exactly what you'd imagine a kind of 80-year-old Battle of Britain veteran would be like, you know, self-deprecating, incredibly charming, incredibly charismatic, you know, brilliantly generous with their time. You know, I remember talking to one guy in a pub and, you know, he's sort of picking up my pint and he's had his another pint and he was sort of going, so here am I in my spit and the Zemi coming down. And you're thinking, God, I just want to hold this forever. This is just amazing. And so you told these guys, and then you kind of start thinking, well, what would I have done? And suddenly you're off down this rabbit hole of which there is no return, because it's such a vast subject. It is a global conflict. The consequences are still being felt to this day. The reach of it was so enormous. The fact that it's ordinary people doing extraordinary things, I think, is incredibly appealing. And I think, you know, for all of us, so what really sucks us into Second World War is the human drama of it. And yeah, on one level, it's kind of 80 years ago, so it's a long time. And on another time, that's a pinprick in history. It's nothing. Mm. And, you know, it's recent enough that there's film footage and artifacts, and you can still go and see a Sherman tank career around and fire and things. And you can still see Spitfires, of course, flying overhead, or P-51s or Thunderbolts or whatever. So there's enough of it to make it kind of feel real. And I just want to understand more. I just want to understand what was going on. I want to understand the experiences of people. I want to understand what was going on. And I want to understand how it all fits together. And it's so vast that you know, I've still got such a long way to go. And I just have this insatiable appetite to kind of learn more and find out more and understand what the hell was going on, and also use it as a kind of as a lesson, you know, because history doesn't repeat itself, but patterns of human behavior sure as hell do. And you know, history is the compass that guides us to the present and prepares us for the future. You know, really is. And, you know, I think everyone should study history. And if you can study history and find it absorbing and fascinating and compelling and rich in human drama, then you can also learn some lessons as well and make sure that you and us collectively don't make the same mistakes as people made in the past.
Yeah. Fantastic. Last thing I want to ask you is about, in your judgment, the proper way to, you know, honor these men who did this and to think about what they did. And obviously it's trite to, in my country at least, talk about, you know, freedom and liberty, and that's very real and often a source of comedy in the US. What is a proper way to honor and remember what those men did in storming the beaches and winning the war of Western Europe? Is it too simplistic to say that they saved Western civilization, that they honored and maintained the, you know, the liberty and the freedom that people like you and I enjoy in this life? Where do you come down as a final question on how we properly remember and honor these very ordinary men doing extraordinary things?
Well, I think we've been very good at that since the 50th anniversary in 1995, which was the first major anniversary that was commemorated in a big way, kind of globally. I remember going to Normandy in 2014, and, you know, there were still enough veterans around then, and they were treated like royalty and rock stars, and quite right too. It was incredibly international. I mean, there were so many different people there, people from Spain and from Poland and Denmark and, you know, and even Germany, as well as Canadians and Brits and, you know, Americans and French and so on. And I just thought, God, you know, everyone's having a really great time. You know, this is just fantastic. You know, and this is what they fought for, so that we could have democracy, so that we could live peaceably, so that we could say what we want without fear of repression, that you have the freedom of speech. So much has been turned on its head since then. It's kind of a different world, isn't it? You know, because the liberal elites have gone too far, and suddenly, you know, what's ultimately liberal is actually becoming illiberal again, and there's a kind of effectively a clamp down on what you can say and what you can't say, which, you know, wasn't there a while ago. I think that kind of that phase is sort of fading again now. But I think the worst thing you can do is be complacent and take it for granted. And I think we've all learned to take it for granted. We all think it'll be fine. You know, we'll still go on vacation. We'll still buy a new car every 3 years, and, you know, we'll get Netflix, and, you know, it'll all be fine. You know, I'll spend my $5 on my enormous mug of Starbucks coffee without even thinking about it. You know, all this stuff has to come from somewhere, and it's been earned, this freedom, this liberty that we all enjoy in the West. And I think there's a horrible kind of complacency which has descended on us, and it just feels like we're all going to get a rude shock if we're not careful. And I think we need to wake up. You know, we need to understand the values that were won so hard. I mean, I've just been writing a whole piece on Truman, who takes over, Harry S. Truman takes over as president on the, you know, evening of the 12th of April, the day that FDR, Roosevelt, dies. My God, you know, he doesn't know anything. You know, he hasn't been briefed. He doesn't know that. You know, he's a senator from the Midwest. You know, he's the VP. He just sort of hangs in the background and kind of, you know, plays a kind of go-between the president and the Senate. You know, and suddenly he's thrust into it. He's only met Roosevelt twice since inauguration on the 20th of January, 45. Suddenly he's got to be brought up to speed on what's going on in the war, what's going on with the atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project, what's going on with declining relations with the Soviet Union, the weight of responsibility, which is kind of thrust on his shoulders. And he's just amazing how he kind of just goes, okay, this is my burden. I am not going to shirk this. And it is about, he does it because he profoundly believes in the rightness of the cause and the cause of liberty and freedom of speech and the right for nations to be able to kind of, you know, tread their own path without fear or threat. And Those are amazing values. And when you look, you know, as I've been doing in the last couple of weeks, looking at his speeches he makes, the speeches that Roosevelt makes before he dies, and so on, you think, God, that's, you know, this is important. This stuff is what, this is the stuff of future world peace. This is what they're thinking about now, these pioneers. Who gives a toss about any of this stuff now? You know, World War II is, you know, on Veterans Day, you sort of go, yeah, go hats off. You know, they were brave men. You kind of see these old guys who seem so impossibly old. You can't ever imagine them jumping out of a landing craft when they were 21. You know, and you watch Fury or you watch Saving Private Ryan, you think kind of Band of Brothers was a really neat show. But you don't actually think about what that sacrifice meant and what people were doing it for and why they were doing it. They were absolutely doing it for a better world. And the better world that emerged out of that in the USA was obviously, you know, culminated in the 1960s with civil rights movement and so on, and to the stage that we are now. But you one mustn't forget it, because complacency is the worst word in the world. Well, one of the worst worlds. And you know, I worry that we're all getting that a bit that way now. And you know, all the lessons of what can go wrong in the world are there in the rise of Nazi Germany, in the rise of Imperial Japan, the rise of fascism. It's all there. And I tell you what, when liberal democracies, Western democracies pull together to a common cause, they are unstoppable. Hmm. The problem at the moment is I don't see any of that unity.
Hmm. Well said. Well, James, I hope in that spirit, people come across this and don't become complacent and look up your work and read your work and appreciate what we have inherited from these incredible people. This has been an amazing conversation. I really appreciate you doing this. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.